Okay, over to you.
Okay. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to this 53rd webinar on the Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on Mikara.us under the subheading Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. Previous episodes of this, the Secret Doctrine and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series, are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com up in the upper left-hand corner for the links. Alrighty, we began last session with a short section called Christianity and the Sun, where we learned that avatars throughout the ages share many similar traits, and that often these traits were and are directly related to some astrological sign, either because of the significance of that time of year, as in the spring equinox and its relation to Aries, as shown here, or because the avatar represented an entire astrological age. We get this, for instance, with Apis the bull in Egypt, and the many Taurian type symbols. Like one point, Isis was depicted literally as a bull and as having horns, bull's horns. We then took a look at the four progressive phases of the sun god based on the seasons. The first, winter, was represented by the celestial child, sometimes depicted as being suckled by a Capricornian goat, the sign wherein the sun first turns northward. Then comes the stage of the solar youth of spring, here represented by Harpocrates and a youthful Mithras. This stage is followed by the mature sun god of summer, represented by such deities as the Japanese sun goddess Amaterasu and the adult Horus, now with a hawk's head. So he's lost that sense of the personal, become the impersonal god that is the representation of the sun in ancient Egypt. Completing the foursome is the autumn sun, represented by the Celtic Mabon, and by Samson, whose sheared locks represent the lessening rays of the sun, which of course happens in the sign of Virgo, which you're going to be looking at a lot today, and she was personified as Delilah, who shorn his locks. And this takes us up to where we left off last time, and a new section called The Birthday of the Sun. So I want to remind you that these webinars are way more interesting when you participate, so feel free to make comments, ask questions at any time. Just keep them relevant to the subject matter that we're covering. Okay. Can we get a reader for this, please?
I'll start us off today.
Great.
The birth of the sun. A pagan set aside the 25th of December as the birthday of the solar man. They rejoiced, feasted, gathered in processions, and made offerings in the temples. The darkness of winter was over, and the glorious sun of light was returning to the northern hemisphere. With his last effort, the old sun god had torn down the house of the Philistines the spirits of darkness, and it cleared the way for the new sun who was born that day from the depths of the earth amidst the symbolic beasts of the lower world. Concerning this season of celebration, an anonymous Master of Arts of Balliol College, Oxford, in his scholarly treatise, Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny, says the Romans also had their solar festival and their games of the circus in honor of the birth of the god of day. It took place the eighth day before the calends of January, that is, on December 25th. Servius, in his commentary on verse 720 of the seventh book of the Aeneid, in which Virgil speaks of the new sun, says that, properly speaking, the sun is new on the eighth of the calends of January, that is December 25th, in the time of Leo the First. Some of the fathers of the church said that what rendered the festival of Christmas venerable was less the birth of Jesus Christ than the return, and as they expressed it, the new birth of the sun.
Thank you, BL. Okay, first, the pagans set aside the 25th of December as the birthday of the solar man. They rejoiced, feasted, gathered in processions, and made offerings in the temples. The darkness of winter was over, and the glorious sun of light was returning to the northern hemisphere. So there are many theories as to why December 25th was chosen as the birthday of the sun god. Most likely is that in ancient times, it was believed to be the date of this winter solstice. In fact, Julius Caesar declared it to be the winter solstice, December 25th. But long before Julius Caesar and the Roman Empire, the Druids celebrated the birth of their sun god, Lug, on the same day. So there's something more mysterious about this date than this Roman assignation of the 25th of December. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Yes. Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The festival of the 25th of December was celebrated by the Druids in Britain and Ireland with great fires lighted on the top of the hill. On the 25th of December, on the first moment of the day, throughout all the ancient world, the birthday of the god Sol was celebrated. This was the moment when, after the supposed winter solstice and the lowest point of his degradation below our hemisphere, he began to increase and to gradually to ascend. At this moment, in all the ancient religions, his birthday was kept. From India to the Ultima Thule, these ceremonies partook of the same character. Everywhere the god was feigned to be born, and his festival was celebrated with great rejoicings.
Thank you, Yvonne. Okay, next. With his last effort, the old sun god had torn down the house of the Philistines, the spirit of darkness, and had cleared the way for the new sun who was born that day from the depths of the earth amidst the symbolic beasts of the lower world. So born that day obviously indicates, you know, the winter solstice. And the house of the Philistines is basically the house of materiality, representing the spirits of darkness. So for more on the rebirth of the sun, let's turn to Gerald Massey. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. In the Gospel of James, the child Jesus was born in a cave. In the history of Joseph, the carpenter, the Christ affirms that his mother gave birth to him in a cave. The cave of Mary, that of the son born in the winter solstice in the sign of the sea goat. Abba Udu, the name of the 10th monthly to December, the month of Capricorn, denotes the cave of light. The cave, or winter solstice in Capricorn, was the birthplace of the Mithraic Messiah from 2410 BC to 255 BC. And this was continued as the cave or birthplace of the Christ after it ceased to be applicable to the solar god. Justin says that Christ was born on the same day that the sun was reborn in Stabula Augeae. And this stable of Augeas, cleansed by Heracles in his sixth labor, corresponds to the cave in the sea goat. Thus the cave and the stable are two types of the birthplace at the solstice.
Okay. Any thoughts or questions so far?
Yes, we have a question from Charlie. He says, does it have any connection to the 12th month and 25 day adds to 7, the numbers 3 Trinity and 7 sacred number?
Okay, I'm reading this chat now. Does it? Oh, I see. Okay. Does this birth date, I guess, this chosen birth date, have any connection to the 12th month and 25 day adds to 7, 3? I don't get it. The number 3 Trinity and 7 sacred number. So how does 3 and 7 relate to 12th month and the 25th day? I'm not sure what he means here.
Charlie, can you explain for us? You'll have to unmute yourself.
I was just thinking of the numerology process there. It's a
3. Well, are you talking about the 3 of 1 and 2 added together for 3 and 25? Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
You add the 7 and 3 together, you get 10, which is even another very mystical number, the process of the 1 and the 2.
Right. Perfected man, and, you know, a perfected man, which certainly Christ would be, you know, 10 is the number of perfected man. That certainly would be a proper number for the Christ, who also has the number 8. But, yeah, interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, thanks for that. I hadn't done that numerological breakdown. Anyone else? Other thoughts? Okay. Next. Concerning this season of celebration, an anonymous Master of Arts of Balliol College, Oxford, in his scholarly treatise, Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny, says, the Romans also had their solar festival and their games of the circus in honor of the birth of the god of day. It took place the 8th day before the calends of January, that is, on December 25th. First of all, the anonymous master was actually Arthur Thompson, whose book, Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny, was published in 1872. So as was both Horus and Mithras, the rebirth of the Roman soul Invictus was celebrated on December 25th. And this was their solar festival. Nothing to do with Christ, nothing to do with Jesus. You know, all of these great avatars, Horus, Mithras, Sol Invictus, and many others, like Lug and the Celtic tradition, were all seen as being born on December 25th. Okay, the quote continues. Can we get a read? Wait a minute. I'll read this. Servius, in his commentary on verse 720 of the seventh book of the Aeneid, in which Virgil speaks of the new sun, says that, properly speaking, the sun is new on the 8th of the calends of January. That is December 25th. So MPH is kind of getting into the weeds here on this stuff, but we'll just go into the weeds with him. Calends was the Roman way of describing the first day of the month, just as the Ides describe the middle of the month, as in the Ides of March, right? Including the day of the calends, the Romans counted backwards to indicate the days before the next month. Thus, the 8th of calends of January actually means the calends plus 7 days before the first day of January, or December 25th, right? Little known. The quote continues, in the time of Leo I, some of the fathers of the church said that what rendered the festival of Christmas venerable was less the birth of Jesus Christ than the return and, as they expressed it, the new birth of the sun. So here's Leo I, who ruled during the early years of the church. To me, it's remarkable that the church gave precedence over the return of the Christ. I mean, they gave precedence to the return of the sun at the solar solstice over the birth of Jesus by, quote, some of the fathers of the church. You know, a perspective that was very quickly abandoned in the centuries that followed. I see a hand.
Yes, James, please go ahead.
I thought Constantine was the last Roman emperor in the middle of the 300s AD, you know, and he was the last emperor and the first pope because he founded the Catholic Church. So there's another.
I can't speak to that, James. I'm not a religious historian. Leo was right there at the end. I think one way I might have gone was the difference between Eastern and Western emperors, because the Roman Empire was divided at this point, and you had an Eastern and a Western emperor. So, okay, next up. So can we get a reader for the continuation of Thompson's quote, right, from this book here? Oh, goes back too far. This book.
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, and I'm confirming what you had said to James. It was the difference between the East and the West.
Oh, thanks, Martha. Good.
It was on the same day that the birth of the invincible sun, Natalis Solis Invicti, was celebrated at Rome, as can be seen in the Roman calendars, published in the reign of Constantine and of Julian, hymn to the sun. This epithet, Invictus, is the same as the Persians gave to this same god, whom they worshipped by the name of Mithra, and whom they caused to be born in a grotto. And there's a reference there. Just as he is represented as being born in a stable under the name of Christ by the Christians. Concerning the Catholic feast of the Assumption, that would be August 15th, and its parallel in astronomy, the same author adds, at the end of 8 months, when the sun god, having increased, traverses the eighth sign, he absorbs the celestial virgin in his fiery course, and she disappears in the midst of the luminous rays and the glory of her son. This phenomenon, which takes place every year about the middle of August, gave rise to a festival which still exists, and in which it is supposed that the mother of Christ, laying aside her earthly life, is associated with the glory of her Son and is placed at his side in the heavens. The Roman calendar of Columella marks the death of disappearance of Virgo at this period. The sun, he says, passes into Virgo on the 13th day before the calends of September. This is where the Catholics place the Feast of the Assumption, or the reunion of the Virgin to her Son. I'll stand corrected. I think in practice it's August 15th, isn't
it? Yeah, but you know, I'll get into that, but the calendar has changed. And yeah, today it's August 15th. And so the calends would have been, you know, the first day of September. So you would be counting backward. That would put it at something like the 18th or 17th of August, which is pretty close, you know, considering changes in the calendar. So yeah, he really gets into the weeds here on all this dates and stuff. I'm not sure why he was so fascinated by it, but we'll go through it with him. So first up, it was on the same day that the birth of the invincible sun, Natalis Solis Invicti, was celebrated at Rome, as can be seen in the Roman calendars published in the reign of Constantine and of Julian. So, you know, the point he's making here is that all these solar avatars were born on this day, right? Since at the beginning of the Piscean Age, it was believed that the winter solstice took place on December 25th, any and all festivals at that time of year would have been celebrations of the return of the sun. For example, there was the Greek Brumalia, shown here, held in honor of Dionysus and Demeter, that lasted from December 25th to January 2nd. And there was the Germanic Yule, a solstice celebration, not of the Christ, but of Udun, right? That also took place on December 25th. Hymn to the Sun is a poem written by the Roman Emperor Julian, who was also a Neoplatonic philosopher and a pagan revivalist. The poem is a praise of the sun god, whom Julian identifies with Mithras, the Persian deity of light and truth. The poem also reflects Julian's political and religious views as he contrasts the sun god with the Christian god, whom he considers to be inferior and false. The first line of the poem, this poem goes on and on and on, but the first line reads, "I call on you, you who surround all things in every language and in every dialect. I hymn you. I, as he first hymned you, who was by you appointed and entrusted with all authorities, Helios, Achebaikrom," which signifies the flame and radiance of the disk. So you could see this sun worship was held and long after the Christian faith took root. And this particular Emperor Julian worked to revive these, what are called now pagan, a very pejorative term usually, which just means spiritual beliefs that had been established well before the Christ, right? Okay, next, the epithet Invictus is the same as the Persians gave to this same god, whom they worship by the name of Mithra, and whom they caused to be born in a grotto, just as he is represented as being born, just as Christ is represented as being born in a stable under the name Christ by the Christians. Mithras, who was in, you know, we did a whole section on this. I think we have three or four webinars just on the Mithraic beliefs some years ago now. So he was identified with the Roman god Sol, but was later supplanted along with all other solar avatars by Jesus Christ in order to, quote unquote, phase out paganism. Some of the qualities attributed to Jesus that were shared by earlier solar avatars are the virgin birth, also attributed to Horus, Mithras, Dionysus, and Krishna, miracles, which were also performed by Asclepius, Dionysus, Osiris, and Attis, death and resurrection, also experienced by Tammuz, Adonis, Attis, and Osiris. Now, this doesn't mean that the Christ overshadowed Jesus didn't also have these experiences, but rather that the church methodically worked to supplant all belief in and records of the lives of these earlier avatar with Jesus. It was this movement to squelch all of their spiritual belief systems that the Emperor Julian fought against with his efforts to restore belief in Sol Invictus. Okay. Next, concerning the Catholic Feast of the Assumption and its parallel in astronomy, the same author adds, at the end of 8 months, when the sun god, having increased, traverses the eighth sign, he absorbs the celestial virgin in his fiery course, and she disappears in the midst of the luminous rays and the glory of her sun. So this is an astronomical version of the Assumption of Mary, really the, you know, the much more the true story, which is the association between Virgo and Leo, you know, who represent the lunar and solar aspects. So the Feast of the Assumption, as Martha pointed out, now takes place on August 15th, August being the eighth month of the year. But up here he says, when the sun god having increasingly traversed the eighth sign. Well, you know, Virgo is only the eighth sign when counting from Aquarius, which begins on January 20th. And, you know, nobody is going to count from that place. It's odd that he would. In both ancient and modern time, Virgo was and is the sixth sign of the zodiac, always has been, because it represents that segment of the ecliptic where the sun is located when it crosses the celestial equator from north to south, marking the autumnal equinox in the northern hemisphere and the spring equinox in the southern hemisphere. That's really what sets Virgo off. You know, when that point is crossed, where days and nights are equal, that's when you enter Virgo, whatever day of the year it is, on whatever local calendar, at whatever time in history, that's the time that marks entrance into Virgo. You know, like I said, why he goes so much into this, you know, I don't really know, but there you have it. I see a hand.
Don't you mean zero Libras when they're equal, the equinox? So you're entering Libra?
So it's the end of Virgo?
Yes.
Is it? That's right.
Yes.
I misspoke, as politicians like to say. It's the, right. It's still marked off by Libra, but Virgo. But it's the end. It's the end of Virgo, not the onset of Virgo. Yeah, of course it would have to be, because the beginning of Virgo was originally set off by the Assumption of the Virgin, which now the Feast of the Assumption is August 15th in ancient times, it would have been the beginning of the sign of Virgo, which is more like August 21st, 22nd, right? Thanks for the correction, James.
Okay, and we have a comment from Magda.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on a minute here. Let me get it all. I'm missing. Oh, there we go. All avatars from every era come down on the same December day. The Jesus Christ descent is the most relevant for us today, since is the last one before the end of these times, the Kali Yuga of this chain. Mm-hmm. And since he changed the ways in terms of occult realization, as Steiner would say.
Yeah, he literally grounded the second ray of love wisdom all the way onto the physical plane, which is, you know, a very powerful way to change the ways, right? Yeah, good comment. Thank you. Okay. I see a hand. Yes.
Yes. Ariane, please go ahead.
Yes. We can see that these kind of techniques of trying to deny other people's beliefs, you know, with the recent situation in India where Modi is trying to create a religious state by building a huge Hindu Nuvarish temple on a sacred Muslim site in a time when, you know, the Americans going after the Muslims. And so this is, you know, a political venture and everything. But I do want to say something about that on a more psychological level, that mm-hmm. there's something very deep in our psyche, you know, archetypically, in which we resonate to certain ideas. And according to my studies and when we talk about the Christ, it's very imprecise. It's that the Maitreya, the Christ, the being that is the world teacher, he overshadowed Jesus. He overshadowed Krishna. He overshadowed Mithra. And these beings are all, they were in their own right, independent and highly evolved initiates.
Right.
But the Christ is the consciousness and the being, the actual being shown by the dove in the Renaissance paintings, who's here now and who's independent of Jesus. And so I think it's important in this room that we differentiate those two things, because the Christ is Ray 2, the second Ray, bringing this, like you said, making it manifest and bringing it into the material realm. But this is not only the role of Jesus. It was the role of Krishna and others before him as well.
Yeah, really good point. And even though there's, you know, this is one of the fundamental tenets of the works of Alice Bailey and the DK teachings, is this dual avatarship, you know, with the Christ overshadowing Jesus. And even though he doesn't, because he doesn't tend to speak in terms of historical events so much, I could see that it could well be also the overshadowing influence of Mithras, of Lug, also called Bel in among the Celts. And there's a Christ-like figure in Scandinavia called Balder, Balder, who is very, very Christ-like, but he predates Jesus. And so you again may have that same overshadowing by the Christ. Thanks for that. That's quite interesting, Ariane. Anyone else? This phenomena, which takes place every year about the middle of August, gave rise to a festival which still exists and in which it is supposed that the Mother of Christ, laying aside her earthly life, is associated with the glory of her Son and is placed at his side in the heavens. The phenomena cited is the Assumption of the Virgin, described by MBH as the sun god absorbing the celestial virgin in his fiery course. The dates for the beginning of Virgo in Roman times varied from August 11th to August 25th, depending on the century. So we can assume that the Feast of the Assumption, which now takes place on August 15th, marked during the early Christian era, the entrance into Virgo, an appropriate time for the quote, absorption of the Virgo in the sun god's fiery course. Even though I have to note, it seems like it's the opposite, because you're moving really out of the sun god's fiery course into time of the Virgin. We see in this observance Christ's identification with the sun, which is in accordance with the ageless wisdom, but was also promulgated by the early church fathers in order to supplant Sol Invictus with the Christ, right? In other words, the sun is by rights an aspect of the Christ, S-O-N and S-U-N. But this was used as a political tool by the early church, especially because Sol Invictus in Rome was so prevalent that the church fathers worked to displace that belief. Esoterically, Mary taking her place beside her son in heaven represents the raising up of the form so that it becomes a fit vehicle for the Christ aspect. This is the esoteric teaching. This is the work of all disciples and is aided by the moon veiling Vulcan, which is the esoteric ruler of Virgo. Any thoughts, questions? Keep them coming, folks. It's always more interesting to have a dialogue. Okay, next, or finally, the Roman calendar of Columella marks the death or disappearance of Virgo at that period. The sun, he says, passes into Virgo on the 13th day before the calends of September. This is where the Catholics place the Feast of the Assumption of the Reunion of the Virgin to her son. I'm not sure why MPH got so fixated on this business around the Assumption, but he gave it a lot of space in this book. Okay, Lucius Columella was a prolific writer on agriculture in Roman times. The 13th day before the calends of September is August 20th, the beginning of Virgo during certain periods of the early Christian era. Okay, reader, for this next passage, please.
God, can you read that for us, please?
This feast was formerly called the Feast of the Passage of the Virgin. And in the Library of the Fathers, we have an account of the passage of the Blessed Virgin. The ancient Greeks and Romans fixed the Assumption of Astraea, who is also the same virgin, on that day. This virgin mother, giving birth to the sun god, which Christianity has so faithfully preserved, is a reminder of the inscription concerning her Egyptian prototype, Isis, which appears on the temple of Sais. Quote, "The fruit which I have brought forth is the sun," unquote. While the virgin was associated with the moon by early pagans, there is no doubt that they also understood her position as a constellation in the heavens, for nearly all the peoples of antiquity credit her as being the mother of the sun. And they realized that although the moon could not occupy that position, the sign of Virgo could, and did, give birth to the sun out of her side on the 25th day of December. Albertus Magnus states, "We know that the sign of the celestial virgin rose over the horizon at the moment at which we fix the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ."
Thanks, Scott. Okay, first, this feast was formerly called the Feast of the Passage of the Virgin. And in the Library of the Fathers, we have an account of the passage of the Blessed Virgin. Here's the referenced tome 1 by Bosobre, written in 1736. He was, by the way, obsessed with the Virgin. We can see it here. He has the Assumption as its frontispiece. The Assumption of Mary is completely apocryphal. It is not mentioned in the scriptures, and there is no record before the 7th century AD of a feast celebrating the event. In fact, the Assumption wasn't, quote unquote, defined to be a divinely revealed dogma by the Catholic Church until, you ready for this? 1950. Okay. Next. So even.
Francis?
Yeah.
Can you go back a minute? Was the writer of this a lady?
Oh, because it says Mrs. I think it's Messieurs.
Or is it Messieurs? Okay.
Messieurs Bosobre and Son.
Okay.
First book. Good catch, though. Right. And there she is. I see a hand. Ariane?
Yes, I just can't resist saying something about this. I mean, first of all, on behalf of, you know, the Virgin Mary, and it's mistranslated, it's just the maid, the young maid. It's not the Virgin Mary. It's a mistranslation, so it's a young maid, Mary. We can see the psychological issues underpinning the need to create a perfect image of the mother. Now, so many people, including us, including me, I pray to the Virgin, or I pray to Mother Mary. I've, you know, been doing it for 10 years. And I think in a really patriarchal, in the history of humanity in the West, it's really the way we sort of balance this feeling that something is really unbalanced in the way we perceive the experience of something higher. And at the same time, you know, Mary, the mother of Jesus, she's now an initiate, and she is in a male body. And there's something about this planet having a female energy, because it's so matter-based.
Yeah.
So that a lot of the energies that are coming in that are spiritualized have to be masculine in their polarity to balance it out. But for those in the human realm, you know, and in a female body, it's really a challenge, because we don't see our face anywhere in the history. In schooling, anywhere. It's totally obliterated. And yet there's this longing for the mother and the nourishing aspect that is so, so deep and cannot be denied.
Yeah, well, that's why I say, to get to the truth of this, I think the astrological, the shift from Leo to Virgo, that astrological pairing, because remember, Leo and Virgo were one sign at one time. And in fact, on this globe earlier in the unfolding of the root races, and because they represented this stage of dual consciousness of the spirit indwelling the form aspect, which is really what the two signs together mean. And so I think we get a lot closer to the truth of this whole idea of the Assumption, you know, when we look at it astrologically, you know, rather than literally. But I totally hear you about the, you know, the lack of feminine deity. You know, you always have Isis, you know, who is very much related. In fact, we're going to be reading a passage from Esoteric Astrology, I think, about the relation between Isis and Mary, Eve, Isis, and Mary. DK gives a very insightful teaching on how those three are related. So we'll be getting there. Thank you for your comment. Really good stuff. Okay, next, the ancient Greeks and Romans fixed the assumption of Astraea, speaking of another feminine deity, who is also the same virgin on that day. Okay, Astraea is not really, quote unquote, this same virgin. Mary was the flesh and blood mother of Jesus, whereas Astraea was a celestial virgin and the last of the immortals to live with humans during the Satya Yuga, just depicted at the top of this chart. The Satya Yuga is the golden age of truth, purity, and harmony, during which humanity is governed by the gods who incarnate and walk amongst them. According to Ovid, Astraea abandoned the earth during the Kali Yuga. Fleeing from the wickedness of humanity, she ascended to heaven to become the constellation, Virgo. Perhaps this is a truer version of the assumption, this ascension by Astraea. By the way, according to the Hindu author and scholar Bibhu Dev Misra, the Kali Yuga, or Iron Age, will end in 2025, the date of the next hierarchical conclave. Of course, that's just one scholar's interpretation. There's many, many different ideas about the ending of this date, but it would seem to be that it's imminent. Okay, next. The Virgin Mother giving birth to the Sun God, which Christianity has so faithfully preserved, is a reminder of the inscription concerning her Egyptian prototype, Isis, which appears in the Temple of Sais. The fruit which I have brought forth is the sun. Okay, so, you know, the Egyptians recognized Isis as the absolute mother, not only Mother Nature, who is Mother Earth, but also the form aspect of the entire solar system. Therefore, Mother of the Sun, I have brought forth, the fruit which I have brought forth is the sun. I see a hand.
Yes, Marianne, go ahead, please.
Oh, are you calling on me?
Yes.
Okay, well, I wasn't gonna say it because I lowered my hand, but the there's a council that takes place. I think it's every 25 and 75 years among the masters of wisdom, in which the hierarchy meets to discuss the where humanity is in its evolutionary journey as a species, as a race, one human family. And so 2025 is supposed to be a momentous year, and we know that there's going to be a very big eclipse in April, on April 8th. We also know that if you look at the Vedic astrology, this we're going into a K2 period, and it's associated with Buddhism. And when I took a little webinar recently, he associated that he was sort of a materialist, although he has many, many good comments when he's not before a crowd. He said that it's associated with Buddhism because Chinese was rising, that China was and India were rising economically, but it could be considered just the reverse of that, that actually it's the advent of Maitreya Buddha, not that he's here suddenly in 2025, but that,
right,
that humanity's ready to embrace a different way of being, not through right. Acquisition, material, gross materiality, and what threatens all life on Earth, which is this kind of focus on thought as things, which is, you know,
right,
the possessive nature of the mind, which is not the direction that we want to go. So right. I hope that's clear, my last comment, but basically yeah. Thoughts are things.
Alice Bailey and her works has the same teaching that there's a conclave every 100 years on the 25th year of the century, and that the new group of world servers was instigated in 1925, which was to prepare the way for the return of the Christ, and that this conclave, 2025, marks the beginning of what's called the externalization of the hierarchy, wherein a number of hierarchy will reincarnate in order to guide humanity into the Aquarian age, essentially. And so, yeah, there's a lot of parallel ideas among different spiritual forms. Okay, I see a hand.
Yes, Magda, please go ahead.
Kali Yuga will end in 2025, referring to the conclave and the return of Christ, you said. How would you transpose that date into John's apocalypse?
Into what?
John's apocalypse in the Bible. Into the unfoldment in the various steps of the apocalypse of John.
That apocalypse takes place in the next round, not at all. And there's a collapsing of the time period when it's talked about, you know, the judgment day or the apocalypse. DK, actually, you know, the Master Dual Ghoul, who Alice Bailey channels, or is the amanuensis of, writes that it will be in the next round of this chain, which is many globes, each with seven root races away. And that at that time, 2/3 of humanity will have stepped on the path, meaning that they will be either an aspirant or higher. And that 1/3 will cease to incarnate in the earth through the earth scheme and will at that time find another path that will be suitable for their development, and that is the quote unquote day of judgment. So it's a very much not connected with 2025 in any kind of direction.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. I see a hand.
Yeah, Yvonne, please go ahead.
I don't mean to upset people, but I have to ask this, you know, after 21 years of Catholic schooling. Joseph was initiate, Mary was initiate. Was she conceived? Did she conceive Jesus in the normal human way? I have to know, was Mary a virgin? It just doesn't make any sense, you know, what we're taught and what, you know, if it wasn't the Christ she was conceiving, it was the, you know, Jesus who was going
this
to
is, be over. My opinion on this is that it is a materialization of the myth to make her an actual virgin. What does it matter?
Well, it does.
Mary, just first of all, you know, the point is, I think, of the virginity of Mary has to do with initiation and the regaining of a state of purity the infusing of the spirit aspect, you know. That's my opinion now, you know. And also, I don't think is it possible? And, you know, hey, guys, I don't want to get into a big discussion about, you know, her actual virginity. So if your comments are on that, let's let it go. Okay. Because, you know, ultimately it's not relevant to what unfolds after that.
Yeah, right. It's just that process of conception is such a beautiful thing. If you think of all the elements coming together and everything, why would they make it not human? Because
I think it's part of this, this slant that Saul and Paul, who was Paul, gave onto the church, which is this that sex is inherently a negative thing, and therefore we have to make the mother of Christ a virgin, you know. But I think that doesn't mean that it's altogether untrue. I think there's a way of looking at this idea of virginity in terms of meaning spirit infused, or I don't know. That's it. I suppose we can talk about this if you want. I don't, you know, if you have,
go on.
If you have, anybody else have a comment? I shut you up.
Francis?
Yeah.
Magda says, Immaculate Conception is something to study through the Isis mysteries.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yes, yes. Thank you. That set my head in a right understanding, which is that when you're looking at the level of Isis or what the Hindus call Mula Prakriti, that virgin sea of undifferentiated matter from which everything is drawn is untouched by that withdrawing of the substantive aspect. It's unchanged. In other words, the dropping out of that a sea of immaculate substance into form doesn't change that higher plane of that immaculate substance. And that this is the true nature of the idea that you can both give birth and remain virgin, that because that which is drawn from you manifests on the lower planes, but that the mother aspect itself is unchanged by that. I'm glad you said that because it reminded me of that teaching. I see hands.
Yes, we have hands and we have more comments. Marguerite says, in ancient times, the term virginity had nothing to do with someone's romantic life. It is addressed by M. Esther Harding. The book is Woman's Mysteries, Ancient and Modern.
Okay. Yeah, well, that doesn't, I mean, that's a teaser. It doesn't really say what it does have to do with, but yeah.
Okay, and then James has his hand up, and Tia did too, but her hand went away. So go ahead, James.
Yeah, I think this, like so many other subjects, is primarily or mainly symbolic and has meaning. You know, it's meaningful. But just like many things in Catholic dogma that were decided, it's symbolic mostly. So it doesn't, like you say, it doesn't matter whether literally it is or isn't. There are just a lot of things that they designed for religion to explain things or to make things appear better. So
thanks, James. I see.
And Tia's got her hand up.
Go ahead, Tia.
Well, I think one interesting thing to think about is that the Gospels were not written at the time in real time. They were written in the significant period after the historical events occurred. If you consider that it's nothing just a religious effort, it also had a social political slant too that people were trying to achieve by telling the story. The whole concept of virgin and women is very, very much a loaded term, and I don't think we need to get into that, but we need to be aware that it has a lot to do with the commodification of the female body and how it has to be wrapped in order to be presentable or honored. And so, all of that plays into this when you talk about personality perceptions. When I think of the concept of virgin, I just think of the concept of a level of purity that was achieved purifying her vessel, her consciousness, you know, as opposed to what the state of her physical body was.
I totally agree. You know, and the use made of the teachings, you know, very much changed their actual meaning. You know, it didn't change their actual meaning. It changed the way those teachings were perceived. And this will be right up there in the top of the list of, you know, concepts where the perception of the teaching was very different from the true meaning of the teaching. Thank you for that, Tia. Some good clarification there. Anyone else? Okay. Alrighty. Let me find my place.
Can you
here.
Hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was talking and nobody was listening. Or I was muted.
You're
Scott
muted.
Says the Immaculate Conception is a tenet introduced to Catholicism by Pope Pius IX in 1854. And then he goes on to say, while the doctrine of the virgin birth teaches that Jesus was born of a virgin mother and thus was without an earthly father, the Immaculate Conception refers to the earthly origin of Mary herself.
Huh, that's interesting. So
and then
the
he posted a really pretty picture of Mary.
Okay, let me pull it all up. Oh yeah, I see. Yeah. Well, that's from Scott, looks like. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, all of that was from Scott.
Okay. All right.
And then we have another hand.
All right, but I want to stay with this for just a sec. So
okay.
The idea of Immaculate Conception doesn't embrace the higher possible doctrine of the Virgin. It just literally has to do with conception, you know, meaning that she was physically a virgin. Is that correct? That's what I'm reading with this term Immaculate Conception. And isn't it so appropriate that it wasn't introduced till 1854, right? That's without an earthly father. Yeah, okay. Thanks, Scott, for that. That does give us added perspective. All righty.
Magda, please go.
I guess it's late. I just wanted to say that it does not matter about, you know, what we're talking about, but it is not just symbolic. And I'm thinking about the stanzas that we were talking about the other day, where this, about the chakras and the second brother. Remember, we left it off at that stanza, and I think I understood enough to say that this is not symbolic. It's as high as below, so it's not symbolic. But it doesn't matter, as you said.
Okay, that sort of leaves us hanging in the sense of, if it's not symbolic, what is it? Are you saying it's literally true, or is your belief?
Yeah, of course. Yes. It's my belief, it's my understanding that it is not symbolic. By studying like all the manipulation the Catholic Church operated on the issue, like you were talking about, you know, Virgin Mary for Catholic dogma is both the conceived, a virginally conceived woman by her own mother, and she conceived virginally Jesus Christ, the Jesus that got inspired by Christ after the connection with the solar deity. So you know, through a manipulation, I got kind of through the opposite answer, which is, this is not symbolic. It's something very real in terms of energies and energy evolution or devolution, energetic white method and black methods. And so this is so important, so relevant to the Vatican, where, you know, where now it's you know, many things are going on within the Catholic Church in terms of, as we call it, the Antichrist, you know, holding the solar god Munus, which is the Latin word for you have the Munus, meaning a real pope has the mandate by the solar god to operate on earth. This particular pope, Argentine pope, Jesuit pope, does not have the Munus. It's a legal Vatican thing, but it's very relevant on what is going on now. In terms of esoterically, of the gods have left us, so to say, in a pop way, meaning, you know, this Kali Yuga's ending. So it's shifting all the equilibriums, all is shifting all the balances, and it kind of the cave of this Antichrist thing that's going on now is, you know, it's this. So thank you and good night.
Thank you for your thoughts. Okay, anyone else? Is that all the thoughts about this?
I have some, if you're open to it. I don't want to derail your thought, because I understand that you have some aims to cover today, but I have a few comments to make about this conversation, if you're open to it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just first of all, this is a very profound idea about this idea that somebody could be a being of light and that we want to work towards purity. But unfortunately, it's totally lost when there's a focus on sexuality, because basically what has happened with the devolution of the church is that you have two problems here. You have the teachings of a doctrine to children before they can think symbolically. So basically children and young adults do not have full capacity to think abstractly until age 25. And so when you pass doctrine down from age to age, it tends towards a more literal belief, because that's what children do. They have a concrete belief. And we all know when we've had an assumption about something. For instance, for me, I was not born Christian, but I was very religious and Christian at a very young age. And I remember when I learned in early adulthood that, well, not so early, but in adulthood, that Jesus and the Christ were two different beings. That was just devastating for me. So I don't think it's okay just to say this is not important. We just need to think theoretically and just move on. These are the deepest issues preventing people to both think in new ways and deeply, but also on the shadow side of all the religions, that when they sort of parsimoniously teach a doctrine to people perhaps who are even illiterate, they take shortcuts, either intentionally or not intentionally, to reach the people, their audience, in those years, in those millennia that these ideas are taught. They get distorted. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is that this idea of purity, or even the idea of sin, is so important for one's psychological and spiritual development, but not so much in the sexual realm, or like with the Jews when they focused on blood and how women were dirty during menstruation. It's that there's something that we need to do moment to moment to purify our emotional life, and that is lost in the focus on Mary's sexuality.
Yeah, it's really good thoughts. There, you know, especially the idea that every new generation learns their spiritual beliefs at a time when they tend to be most literal minded, and that it's very difficult to unlearn, to change those into a more philosophical understanding later. You know, so yeah, good thoughts. Thank you. Anyone else?
I think that's okay. It for now.
All right, let's see here now. Let me find this. Okay. This Virgin Mother giving birth to the Sun God, which Christianity has so faithfully preserved, is a reminder of this inscription concerning her Egyptian prototype, Isis, which appeared on the Temple of Sais. The fruit which I have brought forth is the sun. So there's a definitive passage from esoteric astrology that relates to Mary, relates Mary to both Isis and Eve. And I'm sorry if you feel like I was closing you down, I didn't mean to imply that. What I wanted to do was get to this and read this and then continue with the discussion. So, sorry if you felt like I was shutting you down in any way, because that was not my intention. Can we get a reader for this, please? This is a two-page excerpt from Esoteric Astrology.
Okay, first I would like to say that Magda has put a comment in that it is not by chance that children are under critical attack. Purification of subtle bodies becomes impossible through religious dogmas. And then Ariane has her hand up.
Go ahead. Ariane, go ahead.
I actually don't. I put my hand down and someone okay. might have put it up. I'm so sorry. I'm trying to. Do you want us to put our hands down or not after we
yes,
speak?
That's up to BL. That's do you put them down?
I put them down once they speak, and sometimes they put them back up again. But go ahead and read for us, please.
You're asking me, Ariane, to read?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Okay, let me see if I can get to the right screen. Okay, thank you. Hold on. In all the great religions, the Virgin Mary appears. And this is a study of any book upon comparative religion would prove. I cannot trace for you at length this universal recognition of the task of Virgo. It is needless for me to do so, as it has been adequately done by many research scholars. I would, however, point out that four of the names whereby the Virgin is called are familiar to all of us and tell us much as a whole concerning the form nature of which the Virgin is the symbol. The word Virgo itself is a descendant of and a corruption of an ancient Atlantean root name, which was applied to the mother principle in those far off times. This virgin was the founder of the matriarchate, which then dominated civilization, and to which various myths and legends bear evidence, and which have come down to us concerning Lilith, the last of the virgin goddesses of Atlantean times. The same thought is also to be found in the traditionary accounts of the ancient Amazons, whose queen Hercules defeated, wresting from her what he sought. This is an allegory teaching the emergence of the spiritual man from the control of matter. Three of these goddesses are Eve, Isis, and Mary. They are of peculiar and significant importance where our civilization is concerned, for they embody in themselves the symbology of the entire form nature, which, when integrated and functioning as a whole person, we call the personality. This personality is, as far as humanity is concerned, the developed and qualified expression of the third aspect of divinity, that of God, the Holy Spirit, the active, intelligent, and nurturing principle of the universe. This aspect we shall study in Leo and see there the unfoldment of that self-conscious entity and personality which in Virgo becomes the mother of the Christ child.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, next, whoops, what happened there? Oh, here we go. Next reader, please.
Okay, Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
This is a continuation of that same excerpt.
Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Okay, I couldn't unmute, sorry. Okay. Eve is the symbol of the mental nature and of the mind of man attracted by the lure of knowledge to be gained through the experience of incarnation. Eve, therefore, took the apple of knowledge from the serpent of matter and started the long human undertaking of experiment, experience, and expression, which was initiated from the mental angle in our Aryan times. Isis stands for the same expression down on to the emotional or astral plane. Eve has no child in her arm. The germ of the Christ life is as yet too small to make its presence felt. The involutionary process is yet too close, but in Isis, the midway point is reached. The quickening of that which is desired, the desire of all nations, as it is called in the Bible, has taken place, and Isis consequently stands in the ancient zodiac for fertility, for motherhood, and as the guardian of the child. Mary carries the process down to the planes or place of incarnation, the physical plane, and there gives birth to the Christ child. In these three virgins and these three mothers of the Christ, you have history of the formation and the function of the three aspects of the personality through which the Christ must find expression. The sign of Virgo itself stands for a synthesis of these three feminine aspects, Eve, Isis, and Mary. She is the Virgin Mother, providing that which is needed for the mental, emotional, and physical expression of the hidden but ever-present divinity. These three expressions are brought up to the needed perfection in Leo, the sign of the individual, develop self-conscious, and personality unfoldment.
Thank you. Any thoughts or questions about this? I think it's a very interesting hierarchical a placing of these three mother figures. You know, each representing one of the three planes, mental, astral, and physical. All right.
I have a comment if you're open to it. I'm so sorry. I don't mean to.
Don't apologize. That's fine.
Okay. So just to think about the procession of these three beings or more, when we think about Eve in the garden, and it's she's representing the desire element or the feminine aspect, you know.
That's more Isis as the astral. Eve is the mental. See, yes, up here it says Eve's the symbol of the mental nature.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish that thought because I have a slightly different thinking about it. And so when she's in the garden the snake or the Shakti or the energetic impulse to get the apple and to acquire knowledge and the ability to discriminate from the in the world of duality, the tree of good and evil. Mm-hmm. So the issue there is that's significant because it shows that humanity is different from the animals. We have a rational aspect that's, you know, curious and desirous and always grasping, right? But the other part of it that's not so obvious is that when we look at the apple as an object, or the shadow aspect of that is that when we become possessed by knowledge, then we are lost. And we can see that now, for instance, in the world of technology, where there's a desire for knowledge without being or without ethics. So that's the issue for our coming age. Will we have the being, that is to say, the inner rectitude, equanimity, and psychic strength to be in right relationship to our intellect and to our rational
faculty and to knowledge, or will we be more aligned with the possessing aspect, with the powers, with the cities, with this idea that something could be gained for the individual self by acquiring more knowledge? And that's really what we see now as we stand as a crossroads where, yeah, with the masters returning. And I bring it up because it also is amplified and epitomized by this incredible webinar series that you're doing. Can we be in right relationship to these things that we learn and then make manifest the, you know, these two main ideas that you presented today? So there's Jesus representing consciousness, attentiveness, intentionality, and this other thing, which is about, you know, the so-called virgin birth or purity. Do I have self-mastery? Not so much about mastery only over my sexuality, which is just one small aspect of self-mastery, right, and which the church is totally caught up about, and American media is caught up about. But am I working towards mastering myself in relationship to my negative emotions or my fears or my desires to change my life from what it is moment to moment? And that's the point I was trying to make. And it summed up with that yeah, last passage.
So, you know, the pathway into the dark brotherhood is lower mind. And that's the danger that we face, you know, as a race in terms of which path we'll take. It happened in Atlantean times. It's why the race had to be cut short, because the masters of the dark face, the Atlanteans hadn't developed mind to the point that they could resist the impetus of the dark brothers, were swept in that direction, and therefore the race had to be terminated. And you know, it would seem that the same struggle is with us now, but there's been a much, much more development of lower mind. But will that give way to impressions of higher mind and of soul influence or not? You know, I see a hand.
Yes, before I get to you, Tia, hold on a minute. I would like to point out something that Ariane just reminded me of. When you're talking here of Virgo and Eve, Mary, Isis, I also want to point out that Venus is the instrument of right human relations, and she fits in here with these other ladies very nicely. Her higher, you know, that's her higher esoteric expression, is teaching us all about right human relations, which is essential. So,
yeah, you know, her rays are 2, 5, and 6. And if you think about it, those are the aspects that define right human relations. So good thoughts. Okay, Tia?
Yeah. I just noticed this in reading this time, which just is amazing when we do this group study, that, you know, Master DK says the same thing in so many different ways, but now he takes the whole journey of incarnation down the involutionary midway point evolutionary arc through the perspective of matter, or the divine feminine, which I think is amazing. When he says the mental nature and the mind of man attracted by the lure of knowledge is to be gained through experience of incarnation. And then he goes on to say, Eve has no child in her arms, the germ of Christ's life as yet too small to make its presence felt. The involutionary process is yet to close, but in Isis, the midway point is reached. And then he circles back around to Mary, where we all are, right? And then we get into the evolutionary process. And then he closes it off, which I think he's a master, with the introduction of Leo to Virgo, which solves a mystery in and of itself. If you just Look at how he, the logic of how he, I mean, it's, he's just Master DK.
Yeah,
That's all I
he sure is. He sure is. Yeah, I think a lot is also carried in the idea of the esoteric ruler being the moon veiling Vulcan. That combination of energies, is so indicative of what he's describing here, in these three stages, Thank you, Tia. Okay, good discussion. All right. Next up, while the Virgin was associated with the moon by the early pagans, there is no doubt that they also understood her position as a constellation in the heavens, for nearly all the peoples of antiquity credit her as being the mother of the sun. And they realized that although the moon could not occupy that position, the sign of Virgo could and did give birth to the sun out of her side on the 25th day of December. Interesting. Virgo's association with the moon, which is the esoteric ruler of Virgo, comes from the fact that, as we learned from DK, she rules over humanity's triple aspect. But through Isis, Egyptians extended this goddess's role to include motherhood of the entire form nature, including the sun. So they had a much more esoteric understanding of this goddess. The Hindu goddess Durga holds the same relative position as Isis, for as creator and preserver of the form aspect of the universe, she stands supreme. Note the tiger, which along with the lion and other great cats, is a universal symbol of solar energy. The peculiar phrase, give birth out of her side, means to be a direct extension of the nature of someone, suggesting a subjective rather than a literal birthing. For example, the Bible states, "You are a true son of Abraham, born out of his side." So it addresses more the subjective aspect than the literal. Okay. And finally, we have Albertus Magnus states, "We know that the sign of the celestial virgin rose over the horizon at the moment at which we fixed the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ." Well, this is a stretch. This quote comes from Magnus's On Nativities, a treatise on the calculation of horoscopes. However, it is based on the assumption that Jesus was born on December 25th in the year 1 BC at 9 a.m. Julian calendar in Bethlehem, Israel, which is not supported by any historical or even biblical evidence. One reason Albertus Magnus may have posited Virgo at the midheaven is because he had a life-changing vision of Mary, who told him to enter holy orders. By the way, dozens of speculative birth charts on Jesus can be found on the web. Okay. We're going to pull the plug here. And actually, let's finish this because it'll be finishing this section. So, could we get a reader, please?
Michelle, can you read that for us, please?
Among certain of the Arabian and Persian astronomers, the three stars forming the sword belt of Orion were called the Magi, who came to pay homage to the young sun god. The author of Mankind, Their Origin and Destiny, contributes to the following additional information. In Cancer, which had risen to the meridian at midnight, is a constellation of the stable and of the ass. The ancients called it Praesepe Jovis. In the north, the stars of the bear are seen, called by the Arabians Martha and Mary, and also the coffin of Lazarus. Thus, the esotericism of pagan kingdom was embodied in Christianity, although its keys are lost. The Christian church blindly follows ancient customs, and when asked for a reason, gives superficial and unsatisfactory explanations, either forgetting or ignoring the indisputable fact that each religion is based upon the secret doctrines of its predecessor.
Thank you. So first, among certain of the Arabian and Persian astronomers, the three stars forming the sword belt of Orion were called the Magi, who came to pay homage to the young sun god. Okay, so the Magi was a name given to Zoroastrian priests. There is a prophecy in the book of Numbers which says, a star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise out of Israel. The three stars of Orion's belt point to Sirius, as you can see here. So possibly this sided scepter is Orion's belt, and the star that comes out of Jacob is Sirius. Interestingly, the Egyptians believed that Orion's belt represented the resting place of the soul of Osiris. You know, think in terms of the close connection between Sirius and Osiris. Fact is, there are as many theories on Orion's belt and the Star of Bethlehem as there are on the time of Jesus's birth. For example, there was a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in Pisces in 7 BC, which was considered a rare and auspicious event by ancient astrologers. And many think this marks the time of Jesus's birth. But though this conjunction was astrologically auspicious, it wouldn't have even been as bright as Sirius on a normal night. Others have conjectured that there was a supernova, which can shine brightly for up to a year. And that there was a supernova just before Jesus's birth. I see a hand.
James, go ahead.
Thank you. Two things. In case you don't know, most of the names of stars like these were created by Arabs, I think, about right. 1,000 or 1,200. And there's some really cool names.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I always find it interesting when they talk about the Magi following the star to Bethlehem. There's nothing that could be that big and bright inside our atmosphere that would stop above one town where you could follow it. I mean, anything that was millions of miles away from Earth would appear in the sky, and you just keep, you could walk around the entire planet and not be under it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. There's, like I said, there's a lot of theories about that. Many think there was a supernova that would have been very bright, but it could have just been that astronomers, or astrologers, I should say, and they were the same in those days, would have, for instance, known about a conjunction, right, like the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in 7 BC, and would have seen that as something to subjectively follow, you know, but you're absolutely right. The stars don't move in the sky as you walk towards them, you know, so you can't really follow a star, even though they can indicate direction. Ariane?
Well, I just want to say something and hold it lightly. You don't have to be blown out of the water. You don't have to agree with me. But actually, that star over Jerusalem, which existed just as it existed over Jerusalem and over Fukushima after the bombings and all that. These are spaceships, actually. And I, if you've seen a spaceship and if you've seen good fortune of having that experience, we are not alone in the universe. We are not, like before the Copernican revolution, the Earth is not the center of the solar system. Our solar system is not the center of the universe, and humanity is a small species among billions of stars, and the other planets are inhabited, and they're trying to help us. And so during that time when Jesus was born, there was, because stars don't move, and so humanity was given that experience, and there are those experiences now, and you can go to MUFON, or you can go to the internet, and you can even go to a documentary of the crop circles, in which they show crop circles in England, and you see a small spaceship. They don't acknowledge it because the people making that documentary did not, and perhaps don't even perceive it or don't believe in it. But that's really what's going on, and we need to lift up our heads towards the love and the guidance of other beings who are more evolved than us, and we have to bow our heads to who we are and what is possible with humanity, both the grandeur and also the danger that lies ahead for us. And so to not accept help, whether it's from, you know, the masters of wisdom or other beings who are more evolved than us, I think is naive and hubris. So I just end with that. I know it's probably too radical for many people, but I just offer that to you.
Thank you, Ariane. And we are out of time. Could you give us times for the next webinars, Dia?
Yes, the first one coming up is Greetings on Cosmic Fire this Friday, the 9th of February. Then there'll be The Secret Doctrine on the 18th of February.
Right.
And
then the fourth Friday will be the Treatise on Cosmic Fire again.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, real good. Thank you all. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Thank you. Thanks for all your input. It's really useful. And we will, you know, it's not always the purpose of these, of this dialogue is not to have everybody always agreeing with each other, right? So don't be dismayed. People have different ideas, and that's a good thing. You know, we that way get exposed to different concepts about things. And I think that's really useful. So that's the spirit in which, you know, these conversations take place. So, okay, be well, much love to you all. And we'll see you on Friday, hopefully, for Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bia.
Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.